Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I am delighted to be playing an interview I did with the delightful David Howard. At 82, David is still turning in performances that make people stand up and scream. And in addition to being a brilliant actor, despite what he wants to say about himself, David is a genuine, an open, a real, well, maybe I don't have to say anything more. David will speak for himself. So hang on, here come the show. Hello and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about congruence. That's a term that can be used in a lot of ways, but when therapists use it, what we mean is that what you see is what you get. It's that the person is who they are demonstrating that they are. That is less common than you might think. It is my belief, and also the basis of a lot of the work that I do, that so many of us are hiding significant aspects of ourselves, hiding them not only from other people, but from ourselves. And that quite often, the significant thing that we are hiding from ourselves, the secret that we are keeping from ourselves about ourselves, is precisely the thing that we need to make our life the rich, the full, the vibrant, the correct, the perfect for us life that it could be, should be, is meant to be. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because in order to do that in this culture, it has to be who you really are. We are so discouraging about the arts in this culture. Parents will say, oh, Johnny is tap dancing, isn't that cute? Sarah is singing, isn't that adorable? Amy is painting, oh, look, all these paintings are up on the refrigerator. But just let Sarah or Amy want to make a living doing this, and the blinds come down. What are you talking about? You can't make a living at that. Which is confirmed for their parents by the society. So few of us really hold on to that intrinsic truth about ourselves and make a living or a life with the art that captured us. David Howard is a man who speaks for those of us who have known that there was something about us that was screaming for attention, something deep and powerful and personal and intrinsic to ourselves that we were reluctant to look at, that we shied away from exposing, that we danced around, that we couldn't quite commit to. David speaks eloquently about knowing this about himself for his entire life, that really what he always has been is an actor. And he tells the story of how long it took him to be willing to embrace it, and how much he has dedicated a life to becoming the very best actor that he can be, as he discovered that that is who he is, and he wants to honor it in every possible way that he can. It's a beautiful, beautiful story told by an eloquent and adorable man. And so now, without further ado, as they say, here is David Howard. Okay, I am here with David Howard in the conference room at the Oslo, and David is a terrifically well-respected member of the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company, and has been for
20 seasons, covering a span of 35 years.
My goodness.
I'm definitely the oldest.
How old are you?
I'm 82.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And still working.
I hope so.
Yeah, what do you mean you hope so? I've seen you all over the place this year.
Well, I hope I can keep it up. We used to do six, sometimes as many as five or six plays in a nine-play season. And so we had a rough load, but it didn't seem that difficult for me then. You know, that was nothing. And then when we moved here, when I came back here after being away for 14 or 15 years, I still was able to do three or four shows in a six or seven place.
Are you talking about the learning the lines, or it's just a physically that it's...
Both.
That, yeah, right.
Both. I've never had a problem physically until the last few years when I have a sort of a gimpy walk now. But, learning the lines is getting a little more difficult for me.
Yeah. I don't actually understand how you guys did it,
either.
How anybody does it.
I don't
it.
Either.
Yes, right. No, it's pretty magical.
I used to have a photographic memory, but the film is wearing out. and I haven't been able to convert to digital. But I just all it is, I have to take longer now.
Yeah.
It used to be no problem. I wouldn't even bother learning lines before rehearsals.
Wow.
I would read the play as many times as I could, and then we would get up and we'd read the play on the opening day. Then we'd get up and read a scene. I'd get up and hold the book the first time, put the book down, and I would know the scene.
Wow.
Now I have to take months to accomplish that same result. So it's just a natural process. So I know my limitations. But
you know, I'm so happy to hear you say this, because I think that hopefully we're all going to age. And a part of aging is accepting what happens to us when we age.
Exactly.
And if you fight that, then all that happens is you're miserable, it seems to me.
That's right.
Because you can't be younger than you are.
That's right.
So to hear you say this with so much amusement and acceptance, I think it's so wonderful.
Yeah, I can't fight it. I know what the limitations are. I know what's going to happen. But so what? I'm still very fortunate to be able to be
That's
working
right.
at all.
That's right. You're still doing what you can do, and we are so grateful to have you, my God.
What I still love to do.
Yes.
And let me turn down my hearing aid. Speaking of that, let me just click it onto a different function. Otherwise, it whistles. Okay. It has two functions. One is omni and one is more directional. I've got the more directional one now, which limits the feedback, so we don't get whistles.
Oh gosh! So one has to learn all kinds of new things.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And luckily I have a kind now that has a long life battery. Because there were times when I'd be on stage when I first had my first hearing aids about 10 or 15 years ago, I'd be on stage and all of a sudden the battery would kick out. And there was no, oh, Jesus, I can't hear out of one ear. So I'd have to lip read.
Oh, my God.
But luckily I have a kind now that signals me. It tells me when the battery...
So you can run off stage and put a battery in?
I've done that. Well, not run off.
Right,
stage,
right, right.
You know, if I've had, like, if there's an intermission,
right.
Fine. If there's no intermission, I'm screwed.
Right. Well, but... But again, it's, you know, I mean...
You accept it.
That's right.
And what I try to do is I try to build in, like, my physical limitations now that I have severe bursitis. But I just use it on stage. I mean, I built it into the character. I'm playing geezers anyway.
Right, but it works for you.
Yeah, it works.
Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it's very clear that you have made your life in the theater as an actor. So, I always ask the same question. How did it happen? How did it get started? Do you remember when you...
Yeah. Well, I don't remember precisely. It's a long story, but I'll try to...
No, don't. Tell the whole story.
I got turned on to theater, I think, when I was 4, 5, 6 years old. And I was the fourth of four sons. By the time I came along, my father had started a house painting, worked very hard, and then the Depression hit. But we were lucky enough to be able to drive into the city a lot. And my father would take me to the Schwitz, to the Turkish baths. And my mother would take me to the theater.
Oh my.
She took me to the Yiddish theater. She loved theater. They were both uneducated. My mother was pretty much self-taught. She was like a Yentl in many ways. She made herself, she worked her way into classes, and she learned a lot. She was very bright. My father was a very simple peasant. So he would take me to the Schwitz. We'd visit relatives, and she would take me to the Yiddish Theater on 2nd Avenue. I don't remember any of the plays that I saw. I don't remember who was in them. What I do remember is the audience. I remember being fascinated by the energy of the audience, how much they were into it. The Yiddish theater audiences in those days, there's nothing like it now except possibly black audiences. The sense of involvement with what's going on, the interaction, the participation of the audience. I can remember sitting there and looking at the people around me. They would be talking back to the actors on the stage. They would be yelling, "Don't trust him, he's a goddess, don't trust him." And that fascinated me, that it was such a meaningful experience for the audiences. That stayed with me. Also, there were other influences, outside influences. Both my parents had relatives in the business. My father had cousins who were in the movies. Also on my mother's side, there were a lot of people who were connected with Yiddish theater, mostly in music and dance. But they had friends who were actors, and they would visit my great aunt and uncle, who had a summer home near where we lived in Westchester. And these people would be there, and they would be telling stories, and they'd be doing shtick, and I couldn't help but be influenced by all
and
of that.
And how old are you around now?
So I'm anywhere from age 4 up to maybe age 15 when all this is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and then I got into Purim plays in Hebrew school and the usual thing, and then in school plays. All of that was going on, and all of those influences were there. But I don't think they were the primary thing that made me eventually, years later, become an actor. I think it was something that was happening inside me. It has to be. Because
mm-hmm.
why didn't my brothers get influenced the same way?
Right.
They were all exposed to the same influences, you know, the relatives and the Yiddish theater and all of that. Also, we had a great summer theater in my hometown called the Westchester Playhouse. So I was familiar with the Westchester Playhouse because I would hang around there a lot. But I think it has to be something that is happening inside you. There has to be a need for self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that comes from. I have never tried to figure that out. It's there. I knew it was there, and I denied it.
But that was my next question. When did you know it was there, and how did you deny it, or why?
I must have sensed it was there from the time I was about 17 or so. But I ignored it because I put it off until almost the age of 30.
Wow.
I was very idealistic, and I was going to be a hotshot labor lawyer. So I went. I knew there was something going on, and I knew that I liked the theater, and I knew, in fact, in my school yearbook, I put down as my hobby, characters.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there were signs that were screaming at me.
Yeah.
And I tended to put them off because I must have known inside that there was some need for self-expression. Now, I've heard a lot of actors say they become actors because they want to get away from themselves. I think that's bull. I think that what they firmly believe that. Some of them are very, very good actors. I think what they're really denying is the fact that they really want to express themselves. So I kept putting it off. I got admitted to Cornell. So I went to Cornell. Now, there were all kinds of signs that were happening all during that time. For the next maybe 12 or 13 years, there were signals that were going off. The first day I arrived at Cornell, I went to the activities fair in the main student center, and I signed up for two clubs. One was the NAACP, and the other was the drama club.
Oh, this is so interesting. These are these competing passions.
Exactly.
Right?
The competing passions were expressed in those two clubs that
yes.
I joined that first day. Interestingly enough, I never went to a meeting of the NAACP. I went to one meeting of the drama club. See, they didn't have a theater department the way they do now at Cornell. Now they have a very thriving, very active theater department. You know, teaching acting and movement, just like everybody else. But in those days, they had, the College of Arts and Sciences had drama and speech courses. History of theater, things like that. But the drama club was very active, and I went to one meeting, and I got turned off. Because I was very young, I was just turned 17, and all of these students were coming back from summer vacations, and all the women sounded like Catherine Cornell or Tallulah Bankhead, and all the guys were trying to sound like John Barrymore, and a lot of air kisses, and a lot of, oh, darling, I had a wonderful summer stock, and I thought, oh, Jesus, these people know so much that I don't know anything. Their attitudes kind of turned me off, too, so I never went back. The next year, I was working in, I never went back to the drama club, although I saw some of their productions. Next year, I was working in a cafeteria, and I was working alongside the president of the drama club. He and I became pals. We were what's called runners. We would run stuff from the kitchen to the, serving counters, and occasionally I would go out to the tables and, you know, to take condiments out and stuff like that. So Jim and I, his name was Jim Teppel, we would do routines to pass the time. I would do funny characters, and we would make up sort of all sorts of shtick. And one day he said to me, he says, you have an acting talent. He said, you know that? He said, why don't you join my drama club? I didn't know. I don't remember him from that first day I was there. He didn't remember me because I hid in the background. So that's how shy I was. So he said, why don't you join the drama club? I said, well, I went to the first meeting last year. And I told him why I got turned off. He said, oh, yeah. He said, they're all full of crap. It's a lot of affectation. He said, don't pay any attention to that. He said, but I'll tell you what. He said, why don't you join the Octagon Club, which was the musical comedy group? He said, those people are much more relaxed and they're much more real and they don't have any affectations and if you're talented, they'll welcome you. So I did. I went and auditioned for them. I sang and I read something and I got into their show. And then the next year I got into another show. So these were signs that were telling me something.
Yeah, right.
And then I met a girl at a bus stop smoking a cigarette. And she was very attractive and I wanted to impress her, so I took the cigarette. We struck up a little conversation. I took the cigarette and I did a Humphrey Bogart. I flipped the butt, like, I said, up against the wall, Shara. So she thought that was the funniest thing she'd ever seen. She said, you gotta come down and see me down at Ithaca College. She said, I'm in a show down there. I said, you're in a show? She said, yeah, I'm playing Mariah in Twelfth Night.
God.
That was my first exposure to Shakespeare. So I went down and I saw her do Mariah in Twelfth Night, and I fell in love with the place. And I should have at that moment, had I had the money, had I had the sense, I would have transferred immediately
right.
from Cornell downtown to Ithaca College. At that time it was downtown in the flat. Now it's up on a hill. And they had three departments, and one of them was theater. And I found myself hanging around there, not just because of the girl, I don't even remember her name. I call her Mariah. I can't even remember her name. But not because of Mariah, but because I was fascinated by what was going on, mm-hmm. the life that was happening, to the point where I was skipping classes in my major, industrial and labor relations.
To hang out.
So to hang out. And then I joined a community theater group consisting mostly of Ithaca College people. I went to a few of their meetings, but I still didn't get terribly involved. But the fact that I went there
right.
and wanted to be there should have told me something.
Well, it was telling you something. You just weren't listening.
It was telling me something, but I wasn't listening
right.
hard enough. And I didn't listen hard enough till I was 29 years old. So,
well, you know,
anyway.
You just stop for a second, because I think, I think this is really interesting, and the hearing, the not being able to hear it, or to hear it but mm-hmm. to ignore it, would your family have disapproved of this? Would they?
I've thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a subtle way, yes, but it was my choice.
Well, no, I understand, but something made you ignore the messages.
What made me ignore the messages was a dedication to what I thought was important for
yes.
my family.
Right.
My father had been a hardworking house painter and struggled during the Depression. My three older brothers, my oldest brother after the war, when it became a house painter, worked with my father. The second two became an engineer and an accountant, respectively. Uh-huh. We were kind of expected to be professionals.
Yes.
And everybody wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor.
That was what was...
Or possibly even a doggist. tended toward the law because that's the way my teachers kind of geared me. They kind of pushed me that way. And I thought, well, I have an obligation. I think I felt I had an obligation to do better than my father.
Yeah, right.
I think that's what it was.
Right. Every generation should do better, and you should bring something to the...
We should live the American dream. They came over, right, and they made it possible for us to live in this free country.
Right, and you're going to be an actor.
And you're going to be an actor. Even though I had actors in the family.
Right.
Somehow that didn't fit right.
That's what I was thinking. So, okay, great.
So there was this obligation, but it wasn't like somebody said, you got to do
no,
this.
No, it's more powerful when it's subtle like this.
It
don't
was
you
subtle,
think?
And it was subtle even when I decided to become an actor, because I would get little things from cousins
Stop.
And brothers, like little nudges like, you're going to be an actor? And I could hear them saying, I could literally hear them saying, what a waste of time. He could have been, he could make a lot of money being a lawyer. What the hell does he want? You know, I mean, these were influences that were there, and I had to fight very hard to overcome them.
Yes.
And finally say at the age of 29, no, this is not what I want.
Well, okay, back up, because I want to get to, so now you're only, what, 22, 23, and did you graduate from Cornell?
Yes, I graduated from Cornell, and I went to law school.
Well, good grief.
Okay. There were other factors involved, but those are not that important. Okay. Biggest sign of all was when after I had been working, the biggest thing I should have recognized but did not at that time, when all this was happening, after I had been working professionally for about 6 years, including being a guest, an artist in residence at Brandeis University, and taking a lot of training and all that, I began working when I was 35. So here I am about 41 or so, and I decided that my work was not satisfactory. I wasn't happy with the way I was, with my acting. I knew something was missing.
Oh, okay, wait a second, because you skipped something, a big chunk here.
I'm going back.
Are you? Okay,
yeah.
Good, okay.
I'm going back to that. But I'm talking about one of the signs that I should have recognized.
Right, I got it.
Aside from Mariah and aside from the drama club and the Octagon Club and all that, the
right.
biggest sign of all, I didn't realize until I applied. I had left Brandeis, and they called me up a couple of years later, and I worked in offices in New York. They called me up a couple of years later and said, come back, we want you. I said, no, I want to work on my MFA because I need a backup.
What did you study in Brandeis?
Theater.
Oh.
Well, I was there as a guest artist first.
Okay, but I'm sorry. Just let me ask this question. So you said you went to law school?
Yeah.
Did you practice as a lawyer?
No. Before I finished law school, I said this is not what I want to do.
I see. Okay.
But I finished it to complete the obligation
right,
that I felt.
Right. Because you were a good boy.
That I could say, I did it. Now it's it's my choice.
Right.
Not to practice.
Right. Got it.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That was why I did that.
I got it.
I did it to prove that, yes, I could do it. Okay, fine. Now I'm taking over my life, and I'm not going to practice law because that's not what I want to do inside.
Oh,
I want to do something else, and I've got to do it to save my life.
Yeah, oh, that's great.
So I did that, and I, through a series of circumstances, I got hired at Brandeis. I wasn't happy with my work, so I took a couple of years off and worked in offices in New York, worked for a psychologist as their assistant, doing research and stuff like that. Anyway, I was able to make a living, but I wasn't really happy with it, and I decided I really loved the theater. I had given myself a break to see what I really wanted to do. So I decided after 2 years, no, theater's what I want, and I'm going to go back. So luckily, Brandeis called and said, how about coming back? I said, only on condition that I can get my MFA while I'm there. So they called me back a couple of days later and said, yeah, you can do it halftime. But you have to send this transcript to Brandeis, transcript of your Cornell grades. And for the first time, I really looked at my Cornell transcript.
Mm-hmm.
This is the sign I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
That I had ignored totally when I was there. I got a few A's in my major, which was industrial labor relations at pre-law. Mostly B's, C's, and lots of incompletes. And the incompletes just struck me. I said, incomplete? What kind of a schmuck was I? I couldn't see the writing on the wall. I wasn't going to classes, and I wasn't completing the courses because I wasn't motivated.
Now, you weren't interested.
I was not interested.
Right.
And I looked at my minor courses, which were all in the College of Arts and Sciences, all drama and speech and history of theater and all of that, straight A's.
Right.
It hit me like a thunderbolt. Right. I said, why couldn't I see that before? Because I didn't allow myself to see it before.
No. Because this other thing was really important. The obligations of family, it was very important.
It was extremely important. Mm-hmm. And I had...
So in an ironic way, you got to do both.
Yeah. But, so, I had no problem with I had a problem with my brothers a little. One of my brothers, you know, why don't you stick to the law? And I had a problem with cousins. But I had no problem with my mother because down deep, I think
she wanted an actor.
She really wanted it because she loved the theater.
Yeah,
she was the one who initially turned me on to the theater.
See, this is another thing. This is very interesting because it seems to me that what you had was kind of a very mixed message.
Oh, yeah.
You see, you know, because my guess is that you got that message from your mother that there was something really special about acting, you know?
Yes.
And that was in there too.
I know I got that message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's funny because about the same time that I quit Brandeis and took those 2 years off, I was working at the Champlain Shakespeare Festival. Hmm. I wanted to resolve this problem I was still feeling with my father. The fact that maybe he didn't really like what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But he wouldn't say so. He was a good man, and he wouldn't really come out and say, don't be a fool, No, he sort of was very quiet about it. Well, I was working at the Champlain Shakespeare Festival, and the whole company did 3 plays in rep. Winter's Tale, Othello, and Richard III. So my brother, my next older brother, calls me up one day. I was in Burlington, Vermont. At the festival, he calls me up and he says, Amy and I, this is his wife, we want to come up and see you, see a show. I said, great, fantastic. He said, I want to bring Ma and Pa. Perfect, bring them up. So he brings Ma and Pa up, and the only show they could see was the one on Saturday night, because that's the way their schedule worked out, and that was Richard III. Very complicated history play, hundreds of characters, seems, and you couldn't tell them without a scorecard. So I sat down with my father, and I sat down with my parents at dinner time on Saturday, early dinner, and I gave him a rundown of the show. The good guys and the bad guys. Good guys are wearing this, and the bad guys are wearing this, and he says, who are you? And I say, I'm a good guy who becomes a bad guy, and then I try to become a good guy again, and then I get the hoggets. They kill me. So that much he understood. They're watching the show, and afterwards they all come back to the dressing room. And Amy and Babe, my brother Bernie, they're, you know, this great show, fantastic, that was a terrific show, blah, blah, blah. And my mother is smiling with her hands, like my mother Chana, with her hands like this. Well, how'd you like it, Ma? It was terrific. It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful play. Did you understand it? Of course. And my father, meanwhile, is hanging back, and he's looking at all the pictures in the dressing room, and I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, he's thinking, this is what my son gave up the law for? So finally I say, Pa, what did you think? He says, well, these are his exact words. He says, well, to tell you the truth, I didn't understand the void, but you were wonderful. So I knew...
He's the perfect father, your father.
That was perfect.
That's right.
He was a very gentle and loving man.
That's right. So this is what all parents should be.
To tell you the truth, I didn't understand the void, but you were wonderful. And he meant it sincerely.
Of course he did.
So I had his blessing, but I took the 2 years off anyway. And then I went back up, and then it became a process of a whole different thing began to happen. I had to analyze to to figure out what was wrong, why I was unhappy with what I was doing. I was unhappy with the process of acting. I was unhappy with what I was accomplishing. And there were lots of signs there that I was ignoring. And it had to do with the self again. So it was one thing to be true to myself and say, I've got to save my life and do what I want to do, but it was another thing to be able to put myself into the work that
I
was doing.
Yes.
That was difficult. And I had signs. And I remember in particular my mentor, Morris Karnofsky, who had been with the group theater that I had admired a great deal. He was my mentor at Brandeis, and he was directing me in the show. And it was Paradise Lost by Clifford Odets. And he said to me, he said, David, he said, you're characterizing too much. He said, why don't you just use David? And I didn't understand what he meant. I said, I mean, I understood it intellectually, but it didn't hit me in the gut. I could understand what he was saying, but it didn't really mean anything to me. I'm thinking, what do you mean? I'm trying to play this character. I don't even remember the character's name. But he said, use more of David. Well, apparently I didn't. But he didn't say anything else. Then there was another teacher, very, very highly regarded teacher named Harry Master George, who was the main acting teacher at the American Academy. And he was at Brandeis as a guest artist. He was directing me in Edward II by Marlowe. It was an adaptation, and I was playing a villain, the guy who was responsible for Edward II's execution. And he said to me one day, he said, you're creating a persona. He said, I see qualities in you that I would like you to try, which work against the villainy. You know, a nice guy, a good guy, quiet. You know, he saw these things in me. Mm-hmm. He said, use more of that. He was saying the same thing Morris was saying.
Right.
And I didn't I didn't allow myself to really put it into practice. Years later, so then, anyway, it went on and everybody liked what I did, but I felt unhappy. I knew there was something was missing in my work. So finally I said, the only way I'm going to resolve this problem is to get back, get away from the academic. Oh, I stayed there and I got my MFA and I taught for a couple of years, taught acting. And I probably taught myself more than I taught any of the students. So, but I knew something was wrong with my work. And I said, there's something missing. The only way I'm going to solve it is to get back into the jungle and to actually work away from an academic atmosphere, away from here. And so I quit Brandeis and I went back to New York. And I got myself into the, hired again by the New Jersey Shakespeare Festival. At the end of the Shakespeare season, we did a play called That Championship Season, which is now a revival on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
It's a coach who brings back four of his players every year. Well, one of them doesn't show up because for his own reasons. He brings them back to as the anniversary of the championship season. Mm-hmm. This is the 25th year, and so I played the coach. I was too young. Everything about me was different from this coach. He was Irish, he was Catholic, he was a bigot, he was an alcoholic.
Oh my God.
A real shicko. He was anti-Semite.
Oh God.
But somehow, and all of these things were different from me, but I was able to create that persona. I was able to play all those, but I said, there's something, I gotta try something else. I gotta find something in this guy that I like, that I can play. And so I found his strong love that he had for his players. He was like a father to his sons.
Yes.
The father-son element was what I worked on. And the show worked. And I didn't really understand why yet. So some of my family came to see the play on a Sunday afternoon. It was out in New Jersey, Madison, New Jersey. The New Jersey Shakespeare Festival was on the campus of Drew University. And they came out, and the next day or the day after was Yom Kippur. It was in the fall of 75. So I went back to my hometown, Mount Kisco, and to be with my family. And everybody at the end of Yom Kippur, they had the big meal, you know, to break the fast, which I didn't fast anyway because I wasn't observant by that point. But I went, you know, I was sitting there and I found myself lapsing. I'll never forget this. Sitting at this long table and I found myself lapsing back into childhood patterns. The same childhood patterns that I had when I was 12 years old. Being funny, sometimes being sullen, being quiet. All of these things were happening to me and I was feeling uncomfortable because my mind really was still on championship season. Mm-hmm. So I took my coffee and I went into another room, into the living room. Leon, my niece's husband, comes in. He had seen the show the day before. He comes over and he says, "Uncle David," he said, "you're a fantastic actor," he said. "The way you created, the way you played that guy that's so different from yourself." And all of a sudden it struck me. I had an epiphany. I said, I didn't say anything. I said, thank you, Leon, thanks a lot. And he left. But all of a sudden it struck me and everything was clear to me. I said, no, they don't know me. There was more of myself in that character, in that coach, than my family would ever recognize.
Yes.
But I recognized it at that point, and I knew exactly what Morris meant and what Harry Master George meant.
Yes.
Of using myself. And I said, that's the key. That's the key. That's what's been missing in my work.
Wow.
And I found it, and I realized that that's what I had to do, but I knew it was not going to be easy. Because it's scary.
I was just going to say, it's terrifying.
It's terrifying.
Right.
You lay yourself out there. I said, what I've got to stop doing is what I hear a lot of actors say, they like to act because they hide behind other characters.
Yes.
I say, that's bullshit.
That's not what real acting is.
No. It's revealing yourself.
That's right. That's when it works.
Even one part of yourself, in this case, the father-son part.
Right.
But I said, that's what I've got to find. And it's scary. I said, okay, I've got to be in a situation where I can work on that if it takes the rest of my acting life. And so I applied, I auditioned for two theaters, the Loretto Hilton out in St. Louis and the Oslo Theater, with which I was somewhat familiar because I knew about the Oslo from years before because I came down here to work on a fishing boat. So I knew about the Oslo. And I said, that's the place I'd like to work because I fell in love with this whole area.
Yeah.
I said, that's the place where I can work and work on my craft and have a guaranteed income, be able to raise, by this time I had kids, be able to raise my family and mostly work on my craft. In a situation where I knew the plays were not going to close the first night,
right.
Like Broadway, off-Broadway. So I auditioned for the Oslo and got hired by both theaters the same day. And in fact, Howard Millman was one of the guys that auditioned me, and Bob Strain, who was the artistic director at that time, and Steve Johnson, I don't know if you know Steve, Sharon Spellman's husband, he was there just hanging out. They auditioned me, and so I got accepted by Loretto Hilton, but I really wanted to work at the Oslo. So I called Bob Strain at the hotel where I had auditioned, and I lied to him. I said, I got hired by the Loretto Hilton. I said, this is your last chance. I said, you got to hire me, or I'm going to go to St. Louis, which I really had no intention of doing anyway. He said, all right, I'll get back to you. 5 minutes later, apparently he talked to Howard. 5 minutes later, he calls back. He says, okay, you're hired. So I came down to the Oslo in January of 1976. And from then on, it was a process of finding out how to put that into practice. And it's an ongoing process, and I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm still working at it. But over the years, I became more comfortable with using myself because it's a two-way street. Well, I kept reminding myself of the mantra that Stella Adler used to use. She was a teacher and one of the Adler acting family and a member of the group theater. She was a colleague of Morris Karnofsky. And I can remember Morris saying to me, when he was telling me a story, when he was trying to explain to me about using yourself, I remember he told me the story of how he one day discovered it, where they were doing the Wake and Sing, and he went out to have a scene with Stella. He was playing her father. She was playing Bessie Berger. He said, all of a sudden, he said, we started talking to each other as Stella and Morris.
Aww.
He said, and it just opened the whole scene up. We were no longer Jacob and Bessie, just Jacob and Bessie. We were to the audience, but to ourselves, we were Stella and Morris. He said, and that's what opened my eyes up. And finally, I understood what he was saying when Leon said, you know, you were terrific. So I knew that I knew that I had to find a way of using myself more. And I forget what my point was. It was.
Oh, you were saying something. Using a mantra that Stella Adler had.
Yes, that's right. The mantra was, bring the character to yourself. In other words, be that Irish bigot,
right,
drunkard. Bring all of those factors. Bring the guy who who's lived in Scranton, Pennsylvania all of his life and has a certain kind of an accent. Yeah, you bring all that to yourself. Yeah, you use all of that. But mostly, you find a balance and you bring yourself to the character.
Yes.
And that's what I've been trying to do for the last 35 years. And I'm still working at it.
Well, I think that maybe I'm wrong about this, but we can keep mining ourselves and keep finding things we didn't know.
That's exactly my next point.
Ah.
That's right. I found, in the process of trying to do this, I found out that you not only find out more, in the course of acting, in the course of doing a show, exploring a character, you find out what it is that you need to bring from yourself, but you also find out about yourself.
Yes, that you didn't know.
You know,
I was thinking, there's a chance that there were actually things in David that were like this guy.
Yes, there were.
Right, but that you would not necessarily have been aware of, let out.
That's right.
Because they didn't fit with the image that the David, that, you know what I'm saying?
Yes. There were.
I mean, that wouldn't have gone down all that well in your family, some of those qualities, but that didn't mean that you didn't have them.
You find out that you're capable.
Yes.
The character teaches you,
yes,
to know yourself a little better, and sometimes you find out things about yourself that you don't particularly
like.
But they're there, and you accept them.
Because you can use them.
And you can use them.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's raw material.
Oh, it's so great. This is so great because one of the themes of the show that I do is that I believe that we come out of childhood pretty much in denial for a number of things about ourselves. We all do,
yeah,
you know, because it didn't fit with whatever they wanted us to be, right? Go ahead.
We create a persona.
That's correct.
When we're kids.
When we're kids, that's exactly
and so
right.
So that's what I used to argue with actors when they say, oh, I like to hide behind the character. No, I no longer argue with anybody.
Because there's
that.
No point.
There's no point.
Right.
Let them think what
they
think.
Believe, right.
But what they don't seem to realize is that they already created a character,
right,
when they were kids
of
that
themselves.
Was unreal.
That is, oh, that's so right, David. I agree entirely. I don't know how right it is, but I agree entirely.
Yeah.
And so the point of this show is really that it is in all of our best interests to recover the things that we had to give up in childhood, even if we don't like them.
That's right.
And a true actor, it seems to me what you're describing is a true actor is doing that work.
That's right. I think all artists are doing that in one form or another.
Yes, I think that's right.
Using different instruments, but I think the actor has the most interesting instrument because it's your own personality.
That's right.
And things about yourself that you never really understood. It's a process of overcoming that persona that we created,
yes,
and exploring something that will help our art.
Well, and in this, at the same time, help the person, because I believe that everything that you have to suppress requires energy. So if you don't have to suppress that anymore, you have more energy than, do you know what I mean?
It does help the person, because I found out not only that in exploring myself I became a better actor, but that in acting I became, I think, a better person in many ways by admitting that I had a lot of qualities that weren't particularly likable. I didn't have to be Mr. Nice Guy all the time.
Yes.
Like, I found that in doing Trying a couple of years ago. I don't know if you saw it. Judge Biddle in Trying, who's extremely different from me on the surface. Francis Biddle was the Attorney General under FDR.
Yeah.
And he's in the last year of his life. He's 81, and he hires a secretary who's actually the playwright. And he's trying to resolve all of his problems before he dies.
Yes.
He can't seem to get anything done, and he has to resolve all of these problems, and his secretary helps him do that. Even though they clash in the beginning, mm-hmm. they form a bond at the end, and they become almost like grandfather, granddaughter.
Yes.
But I found out that in doing Judge Biddle, not just the first time I did it here, but in doing it in Fort Myers last year, I found out that there were qualities about that son of a bitch that were very much me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, that's cool. And the director helped me to do that. He encouraged me to do that. And it made me feel better about myself,
yes.
even though I said, okay, so I can be a son of a bitch and I can be very selfish. So?
Yes, that's exactly right. See, you know, this is so wonderful. Because the reason that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, that in order to do that, it pretty much has to be, in some important way, who you really are. Because we don't encourage people into the arts in this culture. We make it very difficult.
That's right.
So it has to be somehow something you have to do, something that's real for you. So when I interview people who do that, you can hear that they are, the psychological term for it is congruent.
Congruent,
yes.
I never heard that.
Well,
I know I've heard of congruence, but I never heard it in that sense.
Well, in a psychological sense, it means that you are who you are. that what you demonstrate is what you really are. That you're not dissembling, that you're not pretending.
I call it real.
Real, yeah, well,
yeah.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right, okay. So when I interview you, it's in everything you say is your commitment to honoring the real David.
Yeah.
You know, even when the way you talked about the early years, the tug of war between getting messages about who the real David is and then not being able to honor that because of the pressures that make us all create personas as children. You know, the pressures of what our family believes or what our culture says or what men or women are supposed to do or whatever it is. But you've been talking since the very beginning about that struggle, that tug of war, to honor the real human being.
It's a tremendous struggle.
It is.
I think another factor that entered into that in creating that persona, creating the unreality, was my place in the family. I was the youngest of four.
The baby, right?
I was the baby.
Mm-hmm, right.
It was a two-way street. In some ways, I was protected. In other ways, I was felt rejected.
Yes.
And ignored. And
especially, you were just another boy.
And I was another boy.
Right.
And there are all kinds of things that enter into it. But I think had I not gone into the theater and had I become a successful money-making lawyer with ulcers and a disillusionment about my life, a sense of disappointment, I think I probably would have tried to figure out what made all that happen. But I haven't bothered because I chose the right path.
You chose David.
Yeah.
You know? And that's a thing that very few people do. The price that you, well, I mean, in an interesting way, a lot of people have to pay a price for choosing themselves over whatever the family thought they should have been.
Mm-hmm.
But you had very kind parents.
Yeah.
You know?
I did.
Yeah, you did.
I really did.
And
I was very lucky.
You were very lucky. And as a result, you became, it seems to me, not only a really wonderful actor, and it's wonderful to watch you on stage, but you became a whole person. I mean, this interview started with me saying how lovely that you can accept aging in the way that you are. You don't have to fight that either. You don't have to say, I don't want to be this.
Yeah.
You say, this is who I am. This is who I am, and that's okay with me. I accept it, I'm amused by it, I'll use it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's very rare, David, and quite wonderful.
I do accept, I mean, I gotta say, occasionally I have a little twinge that says, oh, geez, I finally had the energy I had 30 years ago. We all say that inevitably.
Right.
And I can't memorize the way I used to, but so, as I told Michael Donald Edwards over here a couple of years ago, I said, I'm not, when I was doing Judge Biddle, there's a line in Judge Biddle where he says, the exit sign is flashing over the door and the door is ajar. But I'm not ready to go through that exit door. I said, but I've got to slow down. I said, I can't do the rep anymore because it's just too much work for me.
Right.
But that doesn't mean I'm giving it up. So what does he do? He calls me up a few days later. He says, I got a script for you. And he hands me the script of the Yogi Berra one-man show.
Oh, so wonderful.
I said, you got to be kidding me. I read it that night, and it was a ball buster. I mean, it was a lot of work.
But it was so wonderful.
But I said, there's no way I can't do this.
That's right.
Because I love baseball, and I played a lot of baseball, and I loved Yogi Berra, and I love the Yankees.
And it's a great show.
It is a great show. So I said, as hard as it is to do, I got to do this. So the exit sign is not flashing yet, but it's just glowing dimly, and I'm aware of it, but I'm not going to let it keep me.
No.
I'm not going to let it make me go through the door yet.
No. And David, I mean, I was there at the Unplugged, you know, Mr. Green 2.
Yeah.
So the author says his favorite Mr. Green is you.
Yeah, I just talked to Jeff 2 days ago.
You know.
Yeah, that was nice.
Well, I mean, you're still creating remarkable performances.
I hope so.
Not you hope so.
Yeah.
You are.
I think I have something to give. And I think...
Well, you have David to give.
Yeah, and that's exactly what...
Right.
I think that's why I have a special connection with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because I dazzle them, because technically I'm really not that good an actor. I don't have the technical facility of Brian Torfey or Doug Jones or a lot of the actors, or that Brad Wallace had. But I think what they see is themselves.
Yes, of course, the universal.
They see themselves, and I think that's what I try to stress.
Well, you know, I think that what you're giving them is the real person in whatever role, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think there can be anything more powerful than that. That doesn't require a technique if you can do that.
That's more important to me than technique.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll never be a really technically proficient actor the way I want to be because my voice is not that good and my movement is not that good and I look funny. But I have something. I know that the audience wants to see them some part of themselves, and they can only see it when they see a real person.
That's absolutely right.
And that's what's important to me.
And clearly, because you're still doing it.
And I'm going to keep doing it.
And
as long as
that's right. I think that's a wonderful place to stop. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
So, what did I say? A real person. And what is a real person? A real person is someone who is at least as much as possible who he or she really is. This is not as simple or as easy as it may sound. And if you listen to all of David's story, you hear the commitment that it takes to continue to hear the voice inside that says, this is who I am. This is what I need. This is what I am meant to do. You hear this in one way or another in every interview that I do, but not always as clearly as you hear it in David Howard. His knowing it, his struggle with it, his commitment to it, his embracing of it. He's the poster child for what I'm trying to do with this show. And that is to say, it is possible to recover, uncover, unearth those parts of ourselves which for one reason or another we had to deny. And that when we do that, our life is fuller and richer and so much more our own.